Hello, I'm Steve Livingston and I am the Forest Janny. In this podcast, I speak to people who live and work in the Scottish Highlands and who have a connection to its wild places. At the beginning of 2025, I moved up to the Highlands, and as an outsider myself, I'm especially keen to hear the stories of others who have been drawn to the area. In this fifth episode, I managed to get a chat with local climbing legend Mick Tye at his home in Glenroy. In a barn at the back of his house, Mick has created the Scottish Mountain Heritage Collection, which contains items related to climbing and the outdoors that he's gathered from all around the world. Among other things, Mick introduces me to several amazing artifacts from the collection, which leads to a very special moment for me as I come as close as it's possible to get to one of my outdoor heroes. It's Mick's dream to have the items on display to the public in a museum, and from spending a morning looking at the collection, I hope this is something he's able to achieve. To find out more or to make a donation, visit smhc.co.uk. Present during the interview is Mick's wife Kath. I really appreciated them taking the time to chat and for their generosity with showing me the special collection. Enjoy. We're recording, yeah.
Right, so we've got a mug with the Oman Ahoy on it, and during my time as a mountain guide, I used to take people climbing on Hoy regularly.
Yeah.
And allegedly, and I'm not sure, I don't think anybody knows, but I've climbed it more than anybody else.
How many times?
We reckon about 25.
Right, okay.
Yeah. And some people say that might be a bit boring, but I have to say, very far from it. Every time it's been great fun.
Yeah.
A lot of different people, a lot of different weather, and climbing the Old Man Ahoy, the actual amount of climbing is fairly short. 400 feet right enough, but the whole thing is an expedition. Fantastic. Yeah. So the mug you're holding there was actually made by one of my clients.
Oh, right, okay.
A client stroke friend who went back having climbed the Old Man and got those mugs printed up.
Nice. Yeah. They wanted to remember that occasion.
Yeah.
Yeah. And when was the last time you would have been there then?
Well, another interesting story there, because I have a good American friend called Timmy O'Neill. The climbers will probably know him as probably one of America's most famous climbers. So Timmy O'Neill is a pal of a guy called Eric Wehinemeyer, which is quite difficult to say. But Eric is blind, and Eric is probably one of the most accomplished blind climbers in the world. Mm. So the last time I was on Hoy, or last but one actually, wasn't it? Yeah, last but one. We took Eric up Hoy.
Wow.
Timmy and myself. Mm. So allegedly a couple of other climbers have done it blind, but there's a big debate in the blind world, which I have no part in, as to whether people are totally blind or partially blind. Some people can just see black and white.
Yeah.
But that's not a discussion I want to get into. But anyway, we took Eric up the Old Man. 3 years ago now, and since then I was up there with another pal last year.
Mm. Yeah. And you're allegedly going back in September.
Yeah, supposed to be going back in September. We'll see.
To climb.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
So you're still very active then, isn't
that? Very active, but the climbing days are reducing somewhat with old age and decrepitude and war wounds and things like that.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
What's the main struggle that happens with climbing and aging?
With aging, aging generally, well, I've been fairly active and had lots of accidents and been shot when I was in the Marines and all kind of stuff like that. But I think basically just the legs and the arms and the shoulders in particular wearing out.
Yeah.
A bit of arthritis, this, that and the other. But generally I'm pretty fit, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You seem it, definitely. And you seem it, definitely.
What do I? that's good, isn't it?
And you're still remaining active in other ways? In
very much. We've just been climbing up the northwest for a whole week.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah.
In the weather that we've all...
Oh, stunning.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Really nice. We're a bit frustrated this winter because one of the main things that keeps us fit is cross-country skiing.
Yeah.
And it's
not been able to do any of that.
Well, we've done some.
Right.
but nowhere near as much as we would have liked to have done, so that's frustrating. So normally at this time of year you've got that fitness over from there, but so I'm feeling a bit unfit at the moment, I have to say.
And having been up this way for as long as you have, you must have noticed the change in winters.
Because
I know there's various kind of opinions about, and there's people that are maybe slightly in denial about that stuff, but
it's just
people who are denying it are wrong.
Yeah.
No question about it.
Yeah.
Now, they can argue whether this is one of these, you know, they reckon there's been peaks and troughs over previous centuries. Well, it may well be.
Yeah.
Well, there's no question that the place is warming up.
The speed it's warming up is quite scary.
Yeah.
And we noticed it first up in the Arctic when we were up there with, we've done a lot of skiing up in Norway, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
But on the fringes up there, I mean, they were noticing it
20,
30 years ago. Yeah. It was affecting their lifestyles.
Mm. I mean, having worked in mountainous ranges all over the world, the Alps, the Rockies and places like that, I mean, the glaciers are dwindling. Ice climbs on Ben Nevis, ice climbs in Glencoe, ice climbs, low-level ice climbs in the Cairngorms just don't exist anymore.
Yeah.
I've had a retirement plan to try and ski all the Munros on my cross-country skis, and emphasise try. And we were doing quite well for a few years, and then this year we've done one.
Yeah.
So I'm over halfway now, but I doubt if I'll ever finish them because old age and global warming are defeating us, you know.
That's really sad.
Yeah.
Yeah. My dad was a hill walker in the 60s, 70s, 80s and beyond that. Doesn't do it so much anymore, he's in his 70s, but he reckons that Scottish mountaineering and climbing was kind of in its heyday when he was active.
Mm-hmm.
And it's now too busy, and it's now too different from, and I guess with the lack of actual winters as well.
We've got friends who used to come up for the weekend to go skiing in the Cairngorms, and they've got the hotels up there were geared up for people just coming up skiing. I mean, you just wouldn't dream of that now.
Yeah, yeah.
That's nutty, wouldn't it? He used to come up.
Mm. No, yeah, I think your father was right. The heyday was, should we say the 80s and 90s, and then it started to drop off. But what's happened there, it's less busy in one way, but there's still the same amount of people, but they're going elsewhere.
Yeah.
And the big venue in the last 20 years has been Rjukan in Norway, where obviously further north, Norway, colder place, more ice, and that's been a mecca for ice climbers.
Yeah.
For the last 20 odd years, and then there's places in the Alps, obviously, and now further afield, in Canada, which is I think you'd have to call it a catch 22, because global warming is destroying the ice, so people are flying all over the place creating global warming.
Yeah.
So it's a bit of a downward spiral, I would say.
And what about in this quiet wee part of the world that we're in right now? Are you noticing an increase in visitor numbers to the Glen?
Same as everybody else in the Highlands, we're not an increase in camper vans,
Yeah.
We're actually here talking in Glen Roy, and Glen Roy is one of the most famous geological glens in the world because it has the parallel roads, which are a remnant of the Ice Age, you know. Mm. Might be a subject of another podcast.
Definitely, it's fascinating, yeah.
But the we have, partway up the glen, we have a viewpoint, and unfortunately people come, one, to look at the parallel roads, but primarily to park their camper vans on the viewpoint.
Yeah.
So there's been a vast increase in that.
Yeah.
I think we're a bit protected from anything bigger than a large camper van because they can't get back down the road.
The windy
you come
roads.
Up the road, but you can't get round the bridge. So
yeah.
You get stuck if it's too big. So
right. Okay.
They did try and venture up here with buses and coaches.
Really?
It must be about 15, 20 years ago. Yeah. And a couple of them got stuck.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was it.
Yeah. Okay.
So that has protected us.
So that's a bit of a safety net for you here then just now. Yeah, certainly any time I've been here, it's been pretty quiet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm maybe part of the problem. I've got a camper van, a kind of stealthy.
You are?
Camper van.
Just banked in my drive.
with permission, I should add.
Well, we've got a caravan, so
yeah.
We're part of the problem, yeah.
But I guess if you're doing it responsibly and you're...
Well, everybody says they're doing it responsibly, but then, yeah. You know, you go up the glen and you find where they've emptied the toilet down and the dog's rolling it.
Yeah.
And there's rubbish blowing around, whether it's left on purpose or just, you know, got lost.
Yeah.
And obviously it's the few that are giving a bad name to the many. And at the end of the day, you and I are just the same kind of people. Well, you've got a camper van. I mean, we've got a caravan.
Yeah.
And, of course, the North Coast 500 has buggered it up.
Yeah.
But we're not... Fortunately, we're not on proportions of Sky yet, but there's definitely an increase, but we're not talking vast numbers in our glen, but we don't need any more anyway.
Really complain, because we've had it to when it was so quiet on the Hebrides, and that's been fabulous, and you can't deny other people that they want to go and see the beautiful places.
Yeah.
Just because you say, well, hang on a minute, it's getting too busy.
It's a tricky one, though. Yeah. I'm not really sure what the answer is, because you do want people. I mean, Scotland is a brilliant country, and the scenery and the landscape are
another catch 22, because this is not my glen, but I've only been here 50 years.
Yeah.
And we want people to see this glen.
Yeah.
Because it's so beautiful, and good on them for coming and having a look, and because it's so famous. And as long as you treat it correctly, it's not a problem.
Yeah.
But that kind of thing has happened in Skye, where, you know, people aren't really... I'm not sure if people go to the dreaded fairy pools and all that, they're just because it's on their bucket list, you know. I'm not sure if many of them actually know where they've been half the time.
Well, I remember being at the fairy pools probably within the last 10 years, before COVID definitely, and someone coming up to me with a postcard and saying, where is this exact image? They just wanted to... They literally wanted the kind of picture postcard version of it, and that was
it. Social media.
Yeah, it's got a lot to answer for.
At least we'll say, oh, we'll tell us your secret places, and no chance.
Yeah. Well, that was one of the questions I had for Mick, but he's obviously going to remain tight-lipped about that.
What's that?
Secret places.
About your favourite wild places.
Well, yeah, because, I'm partly guilty, because I've been taking my clients to wild places all my life.
Yeah.
And I've made a living out of going to unusual places. A bit off the beaten track, and that was perhaps one of the things I was best known for. But generally, if you tell somebody of a secret place, a classic example is just to the west here from where we're talking is Knoydart.
Yeah.
And Knoydart was basically one of the great last great wildernesses, and in the 1980s, I think it was, the estate changed hands. Access was better than it used to be, and we saw all the headlines in the mountaineering magazines and the hill walking magazines, the last great wilderness, come and see the last great wilderness. And now the place is packed.
Yeah.
You know, well, good luck to the people who are going there. I can't stop them, I don't want to, but if you tell somebody there's a last great wilderness, it's going to get full very quick.
That's
you know?
The other thing with the population.
And if you want a real secret place to go, just walk up the top of our glen and head somewhere where there isn't a Munro and a Corbett, and that's where it's secret. Yeah.
Well, you said you've been up to
Newcornwall. Well, I, that's actually... So I moved here in January to Speen Bridge to study, and that was one of the first places that I went to, because I've been up in the glen a few times, but I had time to explore. I cycled from the van that was parked to the end of the public road, and then I came across the Bothy, not knowing it was there. Which is always good when you're surprised by things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there's no 4G, there's no internet or anything there, so that to me felt like quite a wild... place.
You kind of inadvertently you hit the nail on the head there in one way, because the mountain bothies, most people listening to this will know what a bothy is, i.e. a remote shelter organised and maintained by the Mountain Bothy Association, but they for a long time before the Mountain Bothies people took over were like secret, if you like. And they're only known secret among hill walkers, you know. And then the Mountain Bothies guys took them over and did a great job. And they were still a little bit secret, and you could find out a little bit on the Mountain Bothies website. Then they decided to publish all the locations, and then a guy wrote a book called The Bothy Bible.
Yeah.
And now they're complaining that the places are in a shit state, basically. Because people are doing the business roundabout and not burying the poo and leaving rubbish in the bothies. Yeah. The classic one is they come up with all the tinnies, the ones that are nearest to the road, and then amazingly, instead of taking the empty tins away, they leave them in a plastic bag.
Yeah.
In the middle of nowhere, where a dustbin man's never been. Yeah, you know.
Yeah, and that kind of, a lot of that seems irreversible now, and I know that some bothies are starting to shut down and may never reopen as kind of...
Well, what's happening there is that the landowners are saying, well, what's going on?
Yeah.
Because the bothies are only maintained by the bothies association with the permission of the landowner.
Yeah.
And if the landowner's seeing damage, he's seeing vandalism, he's seeing dogs chasing sheep, he's seeing this, that and the other, he just says, end of bothy,
well,
that's it.
Like, yeah. Brunican bothy halfway up the glen, that's over the other side of the river. That wasn't a mountain bothies association one, but it was...
Right.
It was maintained by a group called the Brunican Group.
Okay.
And... they were getting, because it's quite easy of access,
yeah,
there was quite a lot of vandalism going on there.
Right,
and the
okay.
final straw was when some of the, it was Fort William lads, wasn't it, left a abandoned a car up there,
yeah,
set a fire to it, and the landowner said, right, that's it. It's a shame, because I was looking at it the other day, and it's looking a bit tired and sorry for itself now, and it's a lovely little bothy.
And is it just lying in a state of disrepair
it's
now?
Gradually, the roof's gradually...
Well, because the estate decided to close it. It was like a private. It was an open bothy for people to use.
Yeah.
And then the kids came with the car, vandalised it, abandoned the car, and then they were told to shift the car, and they went and put a match to it. So all you were left with is burnt out shell.
Yeah.
But then the estate just said that it closed, and then they actually used the excuse that the roof was unsafe. But of
yeah.
course, if it wasn't closed, then the people who maintained it would have fixed the roof.
Yeah, yeah.
But then basically stopped them. Yeah.
Well, Luke Connell fits into, I don't know what the percentage is, but the biggest, one of the biggest uses, I know it's the biggest, but one of the biggest uses for bothies is people who are Munro and Corbett bagging.
Yeah.
So, for instance, if you go to Carrara in the Cairngorms, mm-hmm. which sleeps, luckily if you can sleep a dozen people in there, there's normally 3 or 4 dozen people trying to get in there,
yeah.
because there's the Cairngorm Munros either
yeah.
side. So any bothy that's not in the middle of a Munro area tends to be less popular
yeah.
and better kept and not abused.
Yeah.
And the Munro baggers, they'll all say it's nothing to do with us, but of course overuse is, yeah.
Yeah. One of the other people that I'm speaking to is, maybe you know him, Neil Parrish.
I know Neil, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Neil used to look after Luke Connell Bothy before I did.
Right.
I used to be the maintenance organiser for Luke
really?
Connell Bothy. Yeah,
right.
I looked after it for about 20 years. But Neil used to, yeah. No,
yeah.
Neil's a good friend of mine. Yeah, the Scottish Mountain Heritage Collection was, we're upstairs in my barn, where the vast majority of it resides. There's a couple more sheds, one full of nearly 200 sets of skis. But in here we've got everything. I can read in front of me Walter Pouch's nailed boots. We've got Orion Gaiters, Irvin Butterfield's cagoule, a compass box, neoprene jackets, ice hammers. You name it, we've got it. And this was originally my personal collection that I collected when I was a mountain guide, and maybe 20 years ago now, we got some heritage lottery money to make it into a charity, so it now belongs to you and me and everybody in Britain, basically. Mm. Although it's called the Scottish Mountain Heritage Collection, it's pretty worldwide, to be honest.
Yeah.
And it's all here waiting for somebody to give us some money to build a museum.
Mm.
Yeah.
So that would be the ultimate dream for you then? For
Without
this?
Question. I'm in my 70s now, and hopefully before I head off to the big place in the sky, we can have some kind of museum.
Yeah.
I'm fairly sure that we could find funding even in times of, you know, like they are now.
Yeah.
But to sit down and write millions of letters and fill in forms and do this, that and the other would take me forever.
Mm.
So I'm hoping some... night we'll ride in and a shining hour. We do keep making some inquiries as
yeah.
to doing it. They're in the process of revamping the West Highland Museum in Fort William
mm-hmm.
right now, and they're incorporating some of our stuff in
okay.
their bid. And there is a tiny exhibition in the West Highland Museum. We have a small exhibition in Glenmore Lodge, the
mm-hmm.
National Outdoor Centre. And we have a small exhibition in the Glencoe National Trust Visitor Centre.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I wondered about that because I know there's a lot of stretchers from Hamish McInnes kind of time in the Glencoe Visitor Centre. Would that be part of your collection?
That's our stuff, yeah. Same issue stuff, yeah.
I love all that stuff. You know when you go to like the Clackig and does it, you know when you've got old mountain equipment up in the walls, I just think.
We've given quite a bit to folks to put up.
Yeah. I feel like as a visitor to here, as a tourist or whatever, I just think that the old equipment is just so evocative and just kind of fills the imagination. And
it does, yeah, and people take a double take and think, what's that? I mean, if you go a lot of places in Europe, in the Alps, in the mountaineering towns, if you like, they nearly always have an old display of something in the window, which is an eye-catcher and a marketing ploy, to be honest. I should say on your podcast that the Scottish Mountain Heritage Collection is www.smhc.co.uk, and all the stuff we have here in this room where we're talking is on the website, with some provenance, a bit of history and photographs.
So is there anything that folk could do to help to support you? Or
well, they could donate any old gear they've got and save it from going in the skip. You would not believe the amount of interesting old gear that ends up in the skip. Secondly, they could leave us some money in the will, which would be very nice. It is a charity, so they're not leaving it to me. We have trustees and everything like that. So when I'm dead and gone, the place will still exist. So, the collection will still exist. And if somebody wants to come and polish a primer stove or polish some boots and tidy the place up, they're very welcome to come and help us.
I think there'd be a lot of people that would take you up on that offer.
Mm-hmm.
If the deal meant that they could have a look around.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
So many people,
particularly
up this way.
We should also say that we're not officially open to the public.
Of course,
mainly because of health and safety, would you believe, regulations.
We're not
but if we know the people, we know they're coming and we're here, and they don't fall down the stairs and hurt themselves, then they're very welcome. Yeah.
Something I'm drawn to that I noticed just as you were looking at the, reading out some of the names in the boxes, Tom Weir's camera gear.
Yeah.
Tom Weir's one of my heroes. I grew up watching a lot of his programmes, so you've got some of his equipment here then?
Yeah, well, Tom, I'm lucky that I'm not quite of their generation, but I knew a lot of his generation, and I was very lucky when I first came here, and I'm not going to name drop, but I knew most of the famous names, if you like, in the Highlands from the early days. I didn't actually know Tom personally, funny enough. I knew his wife, Rona, but one of Tom's best friends, a guy called Douglas Scott, not the famous Himalaya guy and Doug Scott. This is Douglas Scott, an old Scottish Mountaineering Club guy, who lived just down the road. So I got to know Tom or his wife indirectly through Douglas. And when Tom died, I went to see Rona, his wife, and she gave me all this gear, along with quite a few photographs and stuff like that. And we have, those who know Tom Weir used to wear one of these woolly bonnets with a little bobble on the top. There's one of them there in
no
that
way.
Box. Yeah.
Would I be able to look at that?
Yeah. You want it now?
Do I need to wear special gloves to take out
the camera? No. We work on the basis that the best way to look at old gear is to get hands on.
You've no idea how important this moment is to me right now.
Well,
I must feel like bursting into tears, to be honest.
Well, amazingly, when I went to see Rona, then we got a red Isle of Barra, and what Steve's not got is a big red nose to go with it.
Not yet, I'm working on it.
When Rona gave it to me, I actually asked her, I was a bit difficult asking the widow of a guy who's not long dead about his gear, but she said, well, go and look in that drawer, and there was about 20 of them in a drawer.
That's amazing.
And even I have a little bit of circumspect. I said, well, I thought I'd better just take one. I wish they'd take the whole. She said, you can take them all.
Yeah.
And I only took one anyway.
That's a piece of history.
Oh, no doubt about that.
I think there's even one of his white hairs stuck in the inside of it as well.
Okay.
Unless that's one of yours.
No, it could be, yeah. Well, a lot of people have tried the hat on, though.
Can I try it on? Is that okay?
Yeah, of course you can.
Do you know...
Get a picture of
it. Yeah, that would be good if you could. I mean, this is going to make for great radio, obviously, me trying a hat on, but...
Yeah.
So, if you just hold it that way, and then that white button
that way
there.
Around, yeah. Different to mine, yeah.
Right, now just move that way because you've got light behind you there. So look, go that way because you've got the light thingy here. Right, this is for radio. We now have a geeky looking guy who looks nothing like Tom Weir with a red hat on and a beard, which Tom Weir never had, but never mind. So there we go. Right, there you go.
Amazing. Thanks so much. That's a very special moment. And yeah, you're right.
We do actually have Tom's camera here, but we can't take a picture with that.
Oh, wow.
In fact, we've got two of his cameras here.
Yeah.
In fact, no, we might even have three of his cameras here.
Is that one of his headlamps as well?
That's his headlamp. This is his box brownie, look.
This is amazing. This is a important moment for me.
All Tom's photographs and his paper archive went to the National Library.
Right, okay.
Yeah, so that actually is available.
Yeah.
Although the National Library is a bit like Fort Knox trying to get in there.
Yeah.
A nightmare.
And presumably that will be in an archive rather than on display anywhere.
I would say so, yeah.
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 Do you not think that there... Well, you were saying about countries around the world, other countries having museums and kind of displaying this stuff. Why is there not anything in Scotland or the UK?
You tell me.
Because there's definitely the interest in it.
Oh, no doubt about it.
There's people that are passionate and interested.
No doubt about it. I mean, for instance, a good friend of mine and people listening to this podcast will probably know a guy called Andy Nisbet.
Mm.
He died a couple of years ago, sadly. Hang on.
Yeah, he was a good friend. That was kind of missing.
Yeah. Was he a local?
He was another. Well, he wasn't a mountain guide. He was a mountaineering instructor. He worked at Glenmore Lodge for many years,
okay.
And he did a phenomenal amount of new routes, particularly in the winter.
Yeah.
And that's how he died. Yeah, but
I can't find him at the moment. I'll tell you in a minute. What I was going to say was that the story and the interest brings you up to date, because people who are ice climbing, like we said in Rook and Canada and Norway and places like that, would be interesting to know how ice climbing tools evolve. So I've got in my hand a Hamish McInnes pterodactyl.
Wow.
And there's no doubt that the pterodactyl revolutionised ice climbing.
Mm.
And I actually was using these in the 70s when I was climbing. And they changed the whole face of ice climbing dramatically.
Yeah.
Probably one of the greatest step forwards, you know.
Mm.
But on a slightly... Slightly lesser note, I can't find it at the moment, but Andy Nisbet, who I mentioned earlier, he came up with a thing we called them trampons. I have to be careful how we say that. And he found that when he was doing what we call mixed climbing, he actually got basically two metal plates and put some old-fashioned tricoony nails on them.
Right.
And fastened them onto the bottom of his boots. And they were... Another evolution, if you like, when we're going from the pterodactyls on steep ice onto the trampons, which for mixed climbing, you know. And then there's all kinds of things, like there's an area where they use ice daggers, daggering into things, a pretty scary activity that lasted not very long at all. But yeah, the stories are there to be told, yeah. The evolution is the word, isn't it?
Yeah.
Same with clothing, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of that stuff is like homemade and kind of DIY.
We love homemade stuff.
And
well, my favourite of all things in our collection is the homemade stuff.
Yeah.
And we've got a lot of it.
Mm.
All kinds of things. We've got clothes, we've got ice axes, we've got skis, we've got everything that is homemade.
Yeah.
And that goes back to a time when people weren't so well off.
Yeah.
When there actually wasn't, or there weren't, any actual climbing shops.
Mm.
They weren't there.
Yeah.
People used ex-army stuff. We've got a lot of that stuff.
Mm.
After the war, everybody had ex-army stuff.
Yeah.
And the shipyards down in Glasgow, where you're from, aren't you?
Yeah.
They had all the technical gear and to make things.
Yeah.
So an awful lot of stuff came out of the shipyards.
Mm.
Yeah. It was all borrowed, of course.
It'll
be handed back eventually.
Yeah.
So the homemade stuff was fantastic. Just like that. Yeah. But that's gone now. Nobody does that anymore.
Yeah.
Too well off.
I imagine. And going back to Tom Weir, I guess he was kind of part of that sort of working class Glaswegians who kind of hitched a lift up to places
the
like the Cobbler and...
Glasgow Bus.
Yeah.
Glasgow Bus, a lot of the mountaineering clubs in the old days, when people didn't have the money for a car, some had motorbikes, some would cycle, some would hitch a lift.
Yeah.
But the organised clubs would have a bus on a Saturday morning from St George Square or something, and they'd come up to Glencoe for the weekend,
yeah.
And that's how Tom Weir met his wife.
Yeah. That's amazing.
She was in the club. I don't know. I think it must have been the Lohman, maybe the Lohman Club. And they came off the hill, and Tom was soaked to the skin. He didn't know Rona, who was to be his wife in the future. And Rona, for some reason or other, had a spare pair of trousers. Quite why her trousers fitted Tom, I don't know. Rona told me this story. Rona told me this story herself. So she lent him her trousers, her spare trousers. And about 5 days later, Tom came and knocked on the door with a neatly washed and ironed pair of trousers and gave her the trousers back. And the rest was history.
I know there was talk of there being some sort of museum in Glencoe for Hamish McInnes.
No.
Is that not happening?
Definitely not.
No.
No. Hamish is Hamish was a good friend of mine, and one of Hamish's stipulations in his will, a guy called Rob Taylor is his, the executor of his will, and he specifically said he didn't want a museum. And he didn't want his stuff going to a museum.
Right, okay.
So Rob Taylor now has quite a lot of Hamish's gear in his cottage in Glencoe. Not in Hamish's cottage, in Rob Taylor's cottage. But I tried very hard for many years to get Hamish to give me some of his stuff, and he refused. But in the last few years before he died, he turned up a couple of times with a pile of gear that he gave me, and we have quite a bit of Hamish's stuff here.
Yeah.
I mean, we have all these various types of ice axes, the pterodactyl and stuff like that.
Yeah.
We have here, once again, doesn't work very much on the podcast, but we here we have a mint condition axe, which was the first ever all-metal ice axe, which Hamish pioneered in the 1960s.
Yeah.
And we've got several of them, but this one must have been in a loft somewhere. It's never been used. I'm holding it in my hand now. It's perfect condition, never been used, and it's a McInnes Massey all-metal ice axe.
Yeah.
Actually, Hamish didn't give me this one. Somebody else gave me this one. But we've got all Hamish's stuff in here. Mountain rescue stretches, ice axes, the whole lot, you know. But what will happen to his other stuff, I don't know. But, interestingly, the executor of his will, Rob, just sent me 3,000 of Hamish's pictures.
Wow.
On a memory stick.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's a job in itself to go through those.
Yeah.
I mean, that seems criminal that that's not going to ever go on display, an item like that, particularly.
Yeah.
I mean, that is, there's nothing else like that, presumably, in the world.
Well, that, in that condition, there are several of these ice axes around, but not one of those in mint condition, no.
And are people, are you still regularly getting donations? From all around?
Yep.
From, people that know you, people that don't know you?
People don't know. I would say mostly, well, about half and half.
And I know you've been asked this question before, but maybe it's changed since the last time. Do you have a favourite item?
Yeah, not really.
Too hard to say.
No.
You like the homemade stuff, though, best?
In general, the homemade stuff is generally, and I don't know if there's a particular item in the homemade, but the homemade in general, definitely, yeah. I have a little bit of a fetish for primer stoves.
Yeah.
Of all varieties. Everybody thinks a primer stove is the same, but there are hundreds of different versions, And because I used to ski for Britain when I was young, so I'm quite like the skis. And they're in another shed, not where we are now.
Why? What is it about the stoves that you like so much?
Don't really know. They're bright and shiny.
It's not, it's a lot of people.
They can be bright and shiny. I don't know. I was brought up with paraffin lamps. When I was born, we didn't have any electricity, and paraffin lamps were in the house.
Yeah.
Very few old enough to listen to this will know about paraffin tilly lamps. There's one somewhere. There's a tilly lamp. I'm holding one up now. These are the tilly lamps that were in people's houses before they had electricity. So that's a lamp rather than a stove, but the principle is the same. It's basically pressurised paraffin, you know?
Wow, that's again another amazing object. Summer Shealings.
That's the latest. I've been looking at summer shealings all my life, and what I found out recently that the vast, don't want to be rude to anybody, but the vast amount of people don't even know what a summer shealing is.
Yeah.
Which is slightly worrying because most of the people I hear, I can guarantee that half the people in Fort William don't even know what one is, and there are summer shearings all around Fort William.
Yeah.
And they are basically where people used to take their sheep, their goats and their cattle in the summertime up into the high hills, and they would live up there for a few months. Mm. While down in the valley where the houses were, then they would be growing the crops, the potatoes and the corn, and they didn't want, one, they didn't want the animals down there damaging the crops, and two, there was good feeding up in the mountains anyway, where there was nice fresh grass as it grew in the springtime, you know. And they were very crude shelters, almost, should we say, igloo in shape, some of them, basically built out of stone and turf. And if you know what you're looking for, they are everywhere.
Yeah.
And the story that goes with them is fascinating, and I'm only just scratching the surface, even though I'm considered a bit of an expert. Totally misunderstood, or not understood at all, and misrepresented by many people who think they know what they are and don't. So I'm trying to right the wrong. I'm not saying I'm the leading expert, but it's getting that way.
And is that a book then, do you reckon?
It could well be, but don't get me wrong, there are other people who know about shearing, and I'm certainly not saying I'm the only one that does, a lot of people do. But there's quite a lot of misinformation. And it's a good word, arcana, and the dark side is that a lot of information that's available from the earlier states is written in Gaelic,
right?
And a lot of the names are either misspelt or cease to exist anymore. Everybody around in the old days, way back 200, 300, 400 years, they'd have a name for every stone in the glen. They'd have a name for every little tributary of a stream. They'd have a name for a tree, even. Oh, they're gone. Everything's gone.
Yeah.
So to try and locate some of these places is a bit of a nightmare. You know?
Yeah.
But no, they're definitely a book. There's been a few books written. Personally, I think some of them are a load of nonsense and some of them are excellent. So,
what do you mean by misrepresented?
Well, I won't go into too much detail, but recently, I think 3 years ago, they excavated MacIan, who is the chief, clan chief of the MacDonalds in Glencoe, when the massacre took place. A lot of Scots know about the Glencoe massacre. And a team from Glasgow University, or Strathclyde University, one of the universities down there, excavated it and called it a summer shearling.
Yeah.
And I was very annoyed about that because it is not a summer shearling. Basically, it was the guy's main residence. It was his house.
Yeah.
They would leave there to go to the summer shearlings.
Right, okay.
And I've been having a little bit of a battle with the... I won't bother telling you his name because it could be libel.
Yeah.
With the guy who rented the shearling. I actually found the shearlings on the Rannoch Moor that they used to go to, and tried to tell him that what he'd excavated was his main house and not a summer shearling, but he insists on calling it a shearling.
Yeah.
And that's very annoying, because he's actually perpetuating a lie.
Yeah.
And that is really annoying. Anyway, I've given up arguing with him because I might be urinating against the wall.
Fair enough. So, plans for the future for you, for your collection, for...
Plans for the future, well, the dream would be to try and find somewhere where we could have a permanent museum. That would be the big dream, the plan. Secondly, getting on with life and trying to do a bit of climbing, a bit of gardening, a bit of skiing, and doing what I've been doing for the last 50 years, 60 years. Yeah.
And you're still adventuring? You're still going out to remote places?
At the moment, I'm trying to get just fit enough on the climbing scene to climb some new routes. New routes has been a speciality of mine on the sea cliffs for the last 50 years.
Yeah.
And I have some new routes to do in remote places that nobody knows about. But I'm not sure if I'm strong enough to do them now because they're quite hard. And I'm So I'm trying to get fit enough to do them.
Yeah. Is that frustrating at times? Are you frustrated by the ageing process?
Slightly frustrated, but realistic. If you're getting old, you can't change it. So, you know, I'm not one of these guys who think I'm never going to get old. Like, life's the way it is, you know. Yeah.
And also, what age are you, sorry?
75.
So you're doing...
No, I'm 75 next week. Are you going to buy me a present? Oh, you already bought me a cream cake.
Bought you cakes. Yeah. I mean, you're doing a lot better than folk that are even 20 years younger than you.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Long may it continue. Okay. Mick, thanks very much for your time.
Good.
Much appreciated and amazing to see the collection and good luck with everything.
Well, anytime. Go and have a look around if you want. Yeah,
I will do. I'll, you may live to regret that, but thanks.
Right.